Good afternoon, I'm Kathy Gowdy, Alternate Defense Counsel, Colorado 28436. I would like to focus my argument today on the admission of the conviction, because it is the admission of the actual judgment of conviction in this case that then chain linked into the admission of them for purposes of the habitual sexual offender. So it's a double whammy on Mr. Wade in that case. The prior felony convictions as used should not have been admitted. They were objected to, and the trial court abused its discretion, and it committed reversible error by admitting them. They was admitted under the specific hearsay provision allowing prior sexual assaults on a child, which is, I believe, 13 CR 310, which specifically states that a conviction shall not be mentioned in admitting such 404B or other acts evidence, which is very strong language and a very strong statute that says practically anything that's a prior conviction comes in, but we don't refer to it as a conviction, we don't put in the actual conviction. In this case, not only...
Which statute was that that says that?
Just a second. I have it in my... I have it marked in memory. I believe it's 18.3407. Just a second. Let me find it for be sure, Your Honor. 16.10.3011.
And you're saying that that specifically says that a judgment of conviction shall not be admitted into evidence?
In subsection D.
Can you read that for me, please?
Yes, I can. As soon as I find it in my notes. This was a very heavy statutory case, so I have a lot of notes. Excuse me, it's 18.3412. I was right the first time. And in subsection, I'm sure it's subsection D in that, Your Honor, and I only have my handwritten notes, not the actual language, but it states that it shall not use the actual conviction or refer to it as a conviction or another crime.
Counsel, I don't see that cited anywhere in your briefs.
I found it in my briefs, if Your Honor. It's on page 13 of my opening brief. In the second paragraph down.
Not in my copy. That says 18.1.3.803.
In the opening brief?
In the opening brief.
On page 13, because I...
Oh, you just said 15.
15, I'm sorry.
Okay, there it is. It wasn't in the table of authorities.
I apologize. I'm not a very good typist.
So wait a minute. Wait a minute. This is 16.10.301. You right. Just said 18.3.412. Which are we talking about?
We're talking about 18.3.412.
All right. Where is that cited in your briefs?
Your Honor, I can't tell you off the top of my head. I don't have a notation to it. I apologize. But it is the governing statute for habitual sex offender. And I would ask that my failures as a stenographer not be read against my client. May I please? The conviction should not have admitted in this whole thing. It included collateral evidence, including the sentence, which is not a thing for the jury. It included other things such as the 10-year sentence. It had a different name. And what it did, most importantly, is the acts could have come in without the actual conviction. In this particular trial, while the judge admitted it expressly by written order for a specific purpose, that of identity, alternate suspect, a knowledge of the actus reus. Once it was admitted, it was utilized by the district attorney in this case for the substantive matter it stood for. In fact, in her first line in her opening, the district attorney said, "He has assaulted another child." That is propensity. That is improper, and it should not have been admitted. She also used statements throughout the trial of him being a registered sex offender. That is so prejudicial, and it is a part of a crime, it's a collateral effect of a crime. It should not have been admitted.
Let me ask you about whether or not there is any authority for the proposition that CRE 404B is one of the limited circumstances which permits admission of past crimes, or it's an exception to the general rule that previous convictions are inadmissible.
In the cases cited by the people in their answer brief, there is such authority, but it is only in the effect of impeachment, where the defendant takes the stand and then the conviction comes in to impeach him with it. In this case, the defendant did not testify.
404B isn't an impeachment rule.
It is not. But the cases that they referred to, Vega and Harper, referred to it as being allowed in as impeachment. It's not allowed in the case in chief. It's not allowed in the start of the case. If the defendant, in his own defense, elects then to put it into play or open the door, then it can come in. And I could find no cases where the fact of it being a registered sex offender was permitted to be in. I would say that would be a very bad precedent to be setting for our trial courts. I also note that the district attorney, in her arguments, made comments such as, "I have no doubt you will find that this man once again committed sex assault on a child." Propensity. It's propensity, clear and simple. It's strong medicine for the jury whenever they use 404B, and in this case, they went way beyond the dose that was permitted. And it was all handled in the beginning of the case by written motion. The judge ordered it in writing, so it is preserved for the record because of the written pretrial motion practice. Secondly, then that conviction that was entered as, I believe, Exhibit C by the people throughout the trial was then used to establish the elements for the habitual sexual offender on children. In that separate proceeding, the defendant had new counsel. His counsel had withdrawn between the trial and the sentencing proceeding and the habitual proceedings. And they did not put it into evidence as part of the proceedings. It is people's burden in a habitual proceeding to meet every element, and they have to present evidence for every element in such a statutory proceeding. In this case, they presented no evidence. They asked the court to take judicial notice of the conviction, Exhibit C. They also asked the judge to take judicial notice of transcripts, which were not yet prepared in their entirety, and which were not certified and which were not permitted to be entered under Rule 80. They claimed that the judge had heard the testimony and that was enough, but that flies in the face of Desigualda, the case cited by the defense attorney and in my brief, that because these are strictly construed, every step has to be strictly met by the DA to meet the burden.
Let's talk about the document, the MITMUS. That came in. But doesn't that always come in? I mean, how else do you prove a conviction without something like that?
It was
a certified copy. That's, under our case law, that's admissible for habitual criminal proceedings, correct?
It is.
So what's the problem here?
In this particular case, because it's a separate proceeding beyond reasonable doubt, they established none of the foundational requirements to establish the Mr. Bakke in that particular conviction, and that minimus was the same as Mr. Wade in this case. It did not establish that it was the same case as the two young women had testified to in the trial. It did not establish that it was Adams County that had occurred in, because that did not come in at the trial. The various foundational elements that would have had to be met to meet the statutory requirement were not met. They had a minimus, and that is that. They don't have identity. They don't have the proper form. They don't have characterization.
I think the people point out in their answer brief that there was some testimony from Officer Dolan that Charles Frederick Bocci was the same person as Charles Frederick Wade, and that was based on Detective Dolan's knowledge of the defendant from the sex offender registry. Why isn't that sufficient?
It may sound like I'm harping on legal things, but these are such technical things.
That's what we're here for.
I know, okay. On the habitual proceedings, they are so strictly technical. There is no case that says this is not technical. You can't just take a minimus and dump it on the judge's desk and say, bond habitual. There was testimony at the trial that that was the same person. That testimony was not reiterated at the habitual proceeding, which they must do in a proceeding to show beyond a reasonable doubt. They didn't tie it together. And when you look at the transcripts in this case, they weren't even certified until 2013, which is after 2012. What the court had in front of him was a partial transcript only of the testimony of the two young women from the 1991 case. Not they didn't have no Dolan, even on a transcript that the defense attorney offered to give to the court, and then the DA loaned to the court. It wasn't even put in the record. We don't have a record.
Could the prior victims have testified at the habitual criminal proceeding? Would that have satisfied this issue concerning identification?
It would have if they had testified that it was Adams County and all the other elements. Yes, it could have.
All right, and so your issue is that it was inappropriate for the judge to simply accept testimony from the trial on the substantive charge in the habitual criminal proceeding, that if people wanted to prove the elements in that manner, they needed to recall those witnesses. Is that your position?
Either that or to recall, perhaps, you know, it's often done by a DA investigator.
Right, they could do it different ways.
Yeah, you wouldn't have had to put them through it a second time. There are other ways to do it. The other fact of it is that they also relied on the actual conviction document, which was Exhibit C in the trial itself, and then just referred to it, and it shouldn't have been in the first place at all at trial. So that error has then kind of avalanched into convicting him to a 3 times the maximum presumptive range of his sentence. Without it being properly admitted in the first place, it's inadmissible. It's reversible error, and a new trial needs to be ordered. I would reserve the last of my time unless there's any questions on that. Thank you.
Okay.
May it please the court, Catherine Adela, for registration number 39218, representing the people. I'll start with the issue that the defendant first raised in this argument, the admissibility of the fact that he was convicted of the prior sexual assault and was a registered sex offender. First, on the standard of review, my review of the record is that the defense opposed the admission of the 404B evidence, but did not specifically raise the argument that came up in the opening brief and here of the fact of the conviction. So I think the standard of review on that issue should be plain error.
The 404B objection was directed at evidence concerning the prior acts. What does that encompass, the conviction related to those acts?
And actually, my review of their objection to the 404B evidence, they moved to bifurcate the second offense aggravator, and the court said, yes, we'll bifurcate that subject to the people's presenting a detailed 404B motion, which they did, and the court admitted that evidence, and there was nothing that came up from the defense at that point to keep out the fact that he was convicted. So that's why I approached this under plain error review.
May I ask a follow-up question then on that? In the motion in limine that was filed, wasn't the specific issue of the prior conviction raised at that time, that it could only be admitted if it was to impeach his credibility?
You're reading from the motion right now. I didn't think that it was. And just to clarify on the impeachment versus 404B, my understanding of both of those rules is that they are both exceptions to the general rule that evidence of a defendant's prior convictions is inadmissible. And the cases that the defense is relying on are situations where there's a reference to the defendant's prior criminality for no permissible purpose. And all of those cases say, as a general rule, and subject to exceptions, a defendant's prior criminal record is inadmissible. And CRE 404B is one of the exceptions to that rule. And does that answer your question?
Sorry. So are you equating a prior criminal act and a prior conviction, that admissibility of each of those should be considered in the same way?
My understanding of Rule 404B was that it included both the act and the fact of the conviction. And the cases that I cited specifically referenced a conviction in addition to the facts of the act. I think both were admissible. The defense raised the facts of the acts as a separate argument and, you know, didn't want to discuss that at this argument. But I understood that both of those are permissible under Rule 404B.
What is the additional marginal relevance of the conviction once evidence of the acts comes in, as it did here? I mean, does it serve any real purpose other than, as counsel says, to paint the defendant as a sex offender so the prosecutor can say, look, sex offender, sex offender?
Well, I think that's actually a separate issue, the admissibility of the sex offender status. But I guess I didn't view this record as the prosecutor harping on it for permissible purpose. I thought the closing argument was very tailored to the facts of those incidents and the similarities to the instant crime, which were the permissible 404B purposes that it was admitted for.
But the brief does talk about the admission of the witness as disclosing the fact the defendant was a sex offender. So the argument, as I understand the argument, it's that's really the problem here. So why isn't that a problem?
I don't think it's a problem for purposes of appeal because that specifically was not what was objected to at trial.
Even if it weren't, it could be raised as plain error, and it has been. So why isn't it an error?
It just seems to be another circumstance surrounding that. I guess I don't have a better answer for you than that. But I think it, you know, if you do conclude that it was error, I think it was harmless. The court gave a limiting instruction limiting the 404B evidence for a permissible purpose, and there was nothing particularly inflammatory about that evidence itself, and that was another of the court's findings. And the 404B victim's testimony was brief, and like I said before, I didn't think the prosecutor dwelled on it in closing argument. And I'll turn to you, if the court has no further questions on that issue, the sex offender status, that doesn't, my review of the case law, I didn't find any in Colorado, but, you know, as I said, in several cases from other jurisdictions, that the sex offender status doesn't fall under Rule 404B, and it's admissible if it's relevant. And I think in this case it was relevant to show the course of the investigation because the police initially began investigating the case after receiving a report that the defendant had been around some minor children. And the officer Dolan, I think Sterling is a fairly small town, was the investigating officer and was also who supervised the sex offender. So he knew who the defendant was and investigated the case from there. So I think if it doesn't fall under 404B, we're just looking at 401, 403, and I think it was relevant to show the course of the investigation.
Was it admitted for that purpose?
The sex offender status, again, wasn't objected to, so there wasn't a specific ruling that that was admissible for one purpose or another, but I think it was relevant to give the jury a course of the investigation. It's a very common tactic, defense tactic, to question the sufficiency and adequacy of the investigation. So I think the prosecution has a right to put on their case and show how this incident came about.
But I guess on this record, is there any reason at all to believe that's how the jury would regard that evidence? And it wasn't used that way. So you're inferring that the jury would put all this together and say, oh, we'll only consider the sex offender evidence for purposes of showing how the officer, or why the officer did what he did, when nobody was arguing that.
I think if the defense had strenuously objected to it, the court might have given a limiting instruction or done something to clarify it, but because we're dealing with plain error review, there wasn't that record, so I don't have that to go on. And I think also as far as the sex offender status, that the way this trial panned out, both the defense and the prosecutor were referring to sex offenders throughout the opening statements and the trial. And, you know, the defense's theory was that another sex offender was responsible for this assault. So I almost viewed it as like a harmlessness or waiver that it was used by both sides during the trial. And there wasn't ever any objection by the defense to it during the trial to limit it or to have a limiting instruction or to do anything that could have given the trial court an opportunity to answer the questions that you're asking me now. So I can, you know, only go on the record that we have. If the court has no further questions on that issue, I'll turn to the sufficiency of the evidence of the habitual offender count. And I think that there was sufficient evidence, and I went through a bullet point in my brief. I'm happy to review all of that. But I think just some basic points is that the trial court can take judicial notice of its own records. And I specifically cited a case that the court can take judicial notice of a minimus. And a minimus is it's a public record. It's not testimonial. There isn't a confrontation issue there. And I think that's you know, where I differ on the defense in reviewing the admissibility of that document.
Did the court take judicial notice of any documents during that phase of the trial?
I thought that the issue of judicial notice came up in the court. It was the same judge who had presided over the trial that presided over the...
Well, I know it was the same judge who presided over both, but did the court during a habitual offender phase specifically take judicial notice of certain facts?
My memory is that it did, but I don't have an independent recollection of where in the record that was, but I thought that the issue of judicial notice came up. And I think this evidence was similar, the quality and quantity of evidence was similar to a case I cited in my brief, and the 404B victims identified the defendant at the trial. Officer Dolan, who investigated this case and was also in charge of supervising the sex offender, so he was aware of the defendant's name change and could verify that we were talking about the same person. And then...
Well, let me stop you there. That evidence didn't come in at the habitual criminal trial, however. That was from the trial on the substantive charge.
Right.
And it was admitted for limited purposes, identity, but identity in the current offense, not in the past offense. It was limited to identity in this case to prove that the defendant in this case was the perpetrator, and to rebut the defense of fabrication, as I recall.
Yes.
That was it. Those were the only purposes it was admitted for. It wasn't admitted to show really explicitly the defendant was the person who had committed prior offenses, which is how the court used it in the second proceeding, okay, without the witnesses being present. So didn't the court go beyond the limited purposes for which it had been admitted?
I don't think so. Identity was one of the purposes, and there wasn't any... I mean, the defendant had the opportunity to cross-examine these 403B victims at the trial, and there was never any issue raised as to that they were confused about the person that they were testifying against. In this case.
Excuse me, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
And then we also have the minimus is identifying him and giving the case numbers and the dates. And defense counsel, I can't remember whether it was at the trial or the habitual phase, but actually referenced the, you know, the 91 CR 1868, which was the prior case, and informed the court that it involved both of the 404B victims. So I think we do have those ties to the same case. And we also have the defendant admitting that he was convicted of similar allegations in 1993, which was the same date of the convictions involving those 404B victims.
But why would defense counsel have any motivation to cross-examine about the defendant's identity as being the same person in the prior convictions or the old conviction when we're not talking about habitual offender status at that point? We're talking solely about the substantive charges during the initial trial.
No, I understand it's a, you know, it's a difference in
I can see that there's a different motivation to cross-examine, and I certainly hear your point on that. I guess I didn't, in talking about sufficiency of the evidence, I thought that was the, that to me seems to be a different issue than sufficiency. It almost seems more of like a, you know, due process claim preclusion type thing. But in reading the opening brief and the reply, it seemed to me just dealing with sufficiency. And it seemed to me the same, that there was sufficient evidence based on what those victims testified to, the minimus, Officer Rowland's identification of the defendant referencing prior name change, the defendant's admission, and then the four of your victims in court identification of the defendant.
But you mentioned your bullet point list in your answer brief, and it appears to me that all the information that you provided in that bullet point list emanated from the effort to admit 404B evidence. And all of the 404B evidence, therefore, would have been limited to the particular purposes that the court ruled on, identity.
Being one of those purposes.
But identity, it would make no sense to say that this is limited to the purpose of proving the identity of the defendant as an habitual offender or as being the same person in the original prosecution back in 1993. It obviously refers to the defendant as identity as the perpetrator of the present charge.
Right. No, I understand, but in order to admit the 404B evidence in the first place, the court has to find, you know, sufficient evidence that the defendant was the perpetrator of those crimes in those cases to even admit it in the first place.
But that's using a preponderance standard, right?
Yes, it is a different standard.
So if that's the standard for the admission of 404B, why would admitting it in the habitual offender where it's a different standard be appropriate?
Well, the fact finder in the habitual offender count is the trial court, and I certainly think the trial court could have been clearer in its ruling, and certainly would have been a wiser practice to just go through all of the motions and hold a more thorough separate habitual offender hearing. But I think it was implicit to me when the court was finding beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was that person, that the court was aware of the different standards of proof and was finding beyond a reasonable doubt based on the prior events.
I think my concern is when you say it would have been better to go through the motions, we're actually talking about something that's bigger than going through the motions in order to convict as a habitual offender.
I understand that. I apologize. I wasn't intending to disrespect anything. I guess I just meant that the minimus is a public record. It is not a testimonial document. There isn't a confrontation issue there. And that's what I meant, the pen packs. And that all of the admission of that doesn't need the 404B victim's testimony to have sufficient evidence of identity. Typically, at the habitual phase, there is not evidence of the victims of the prior crimes. It's typically a packet of information, a certified copy of the judgment of conviction in the prior case that was admitted. And that was what was admitted in this case. So I think the court was finding that the admission during the trial was the same thing that it would have done in admitting it in the habitual phase.
Counsel, I know we're over time, but I have some questions on this. We have case law that says admitting the mitmus or just the judgment of conviction is insufficient as a matter of law by itself to establish the identity of that it's the same person. Okay, you need something additional here. Here it seems the court's relying on this testimony of these witnesses who testified at trial. And I understand the objection to be that to the procedure, that it is improper for the court to simply take judicial notice or whatever it did of the prior testimony because there is a confrontation problem. Confrontation doesn't, there are two aspects to this. Yes, if the defendant had an opportunity to cross-examine, that's one part of it, but the prosecution would also have to show the witnesses are unavailable. Not here. I mean, there's no showing, no discussion, nothing. So don't we have a confrontation problem by virtue of the way the court handled this?
I see what you're saying.
Thank you.
I'm over time. The court has no further question to ask that you affirm.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Dowdy, you have about 2.5 minutes left.
Thank you. I used the time to try to find that statute. And it is 1610.301. I apologize again for not having it in my table of authorities. Subsection E says, the court, in instructing the jury and the parties when making statements in the presence of the jury, shall use the words other act or transaction, and at no time shall refer to other offense, other crime, or other terms with a similar connotation. So the court's order in itself, the 404B, is improperly admitted. And in the question you asked about the preponderance, we have something that's admitted for a limited purpose under a reduced level of scrutiny, and then it's offered for its substantive value in a reasonable doubt proceeding, for the truth of the matter asserted. The conviction in the initial case served none of the elements that needed to be proved for that case. It didn't go to any of the elements. And the conviction's admission then was jerry-rigged in to use for the habitual, and it should not have been. There are proceedings, and there are rules, and there's elements, and we need to follow them. And while the facts of this case are unpleasant, I would ask that bad facts not make bad law and bad precedent in this state for trials. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments. Your arguments will be very helpful to the court in reaching its decision. The matter will stand submitted to the court, and an opinion will issue in due course.